Hello, welcome to this week's Pivot to Asia program. My name is John Harrison. The World Cup is now over, and we can perhaps be grateful that sport is still capable of bringing the world together. However, one question that is rarely asked, is the World Cup really a competition that covers the whole world, or only a part of it? Out of the 32 teams which qualified for this World Cup, the only Asian teams which entered the championship were Saudi Arabia, Japan, and South Korea. Is this the new norm? Is the idea of football being a global sport perhaps a little bit rather optimistic, as in many Asian countries such as China, where football was introduced in the early 1990s, football is a newcomer? To talk about this issue, I welcome to the program Professor Stephen Wagg from the Leeds Beckett University, where he teaches courses on history and politics of sport and the mass media. Welcome to the program, Professor Wagg.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, let's start off with a very general question, please. Why do we in the West think that football is a world sport?
I think firstly because it's without a doubt the world's most popular sport. It's a sport that's played and enjoyed in every country, and not a whole lot of other sports fit that description. A lot of sports are still contoured by the old British Empire, for example, cricket, rugby union, so on.
Mm.
But I think that's also, probably aptly in this context, I think that's the beginning of a conversation rather than the end of one.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on really why we value football. What do we want it for?
Mm-hmm. It just seems to me rather odd that, you know, a country like China, which is obviously not a footballing country by default, and they have other sports which they excel in, we probably don't even know much about.
Sure.
They feel the need to compete in the World Cup for prestige reasons.
Yeah.
They're only beginning, aren't they? I mean, they're spending vast amounts, I hear, on new academies, and they're going to be training thousands and thousands of young boys how to play
yeah.
football. But somehow one wonders, I mean, I wonder, looking at it from a distance, whether they really sort of feel like they should be doing it because the other people are doing it, rather than they want to do it themselves.
Sport really here, I think, is a means to that end. It's not that the Chinese government suddenly values football intrinsically any more than it valued athletics intrinsically. The Communist Party of China actually had a cricket strategy for a while, which I think it abandoned. I think the common factor here is that China, like a number of other countries, want to demonstrate that they're a world power.
Yep.
And that they're a big player on the international stage. And international sport, that the staging of international competitions, that the entry into international competitions is a means to that end. And I've no doubt that we'll see China bidding to stage a World Cup before very long.
About China again, obviously we've got a situation where then football then is, could you say that it's become, I don't know what the word is, politicized, sounds rather heavy, doesn't it? But it's definitely become a way for developing countries, I guess China still is a developing country, to show its prowess and compete with the rest of the world, and the rest of the world in this case being the West, as football emanated from the West. I guess my question then is, for us it's different, isn't it? For us Westerners, because football, we always had football. It's something that's been with, you know, in our culture for a few hundred years, but it hasn't in the China, has it? I mean, they feel they have to sort of get on board this thing.
There's a number of questions in there,
yeah.
I think. Number one, football's always been politicized in some way or other. It's just that the nature of the politics has changed, the society's changed. There's no...
Yeah.
To me, there's no sport outside of politics. There's always people organizing it in one way or another, and the nature of that organization has changed a great deal in the history of sport. Secondly, I think, you know, there have been ball games all over the world from which football is loosely descended. I mean, it's generally accepted that the football that we play was incubated one way or another in the British public schools and the elite universities. But equally, Italy had its game, Calcio, and there were ball games in China just the same, I've no doubt. The third thing is development. You know, it really depends what you call development. And that seems to me now, looking around the world, to be the crux of the argument. The way we've launched into this discussion, we're kind of assuming that a developing nation has to have an elite football team in order to show that it's fully developed. But that's really hotly contested in parts of the world, notably in Brazil, which has for many years been regarded as the world's premier football nation. But if you look at the recent politics there, there's been a lot of opposition to the amount of government money that was invested in these tournaments. Brazil recently staged both the World Cup and the Olympics, but it did so in the teeth of enormous opposition from groups within Brazil that wanted money spent on other things, you know, housing, schools, hospitals, and jobs. And I think that's why I say, what do we mean by football? Because in my lifetime, football has been converted from something which was a good thing for people to do into something which is a good thing for people to watch. And I'm not sure that's a wholly good thing.
Okay. Could we then say that football has become institutionalized in the West, at least, and some countries are fighting against that?
Well, yeah, I think it's also important to say, I mean, I think your interest was triggered by the fact that a lot of nations, as you said in your preamble, are kind of left out. But I think the nature of the institutionalization of football already leaves them out. If you take Africa, for example, or Asia, but Africa is the best example here. Most of the best African players already play in Europe. They benefit European clubs and European football cultures. African football culture, indigenous African football culture, therefore, is impoverished. So there is that, you know, that in a way, colonization continues by other means. You know, European money, the Spanish League, the Italian League, the Premiership, draws talent away from its home continent very often at the sort of ages you mention. You know, the big clubs have academies in Africa now, which are for children of a very young age. And in time, they come to Europe to develop their skills. So we're witnessing, I think, a pillaging of third world, if I can still use that term, football talent. And at the same time, as I think you hinted, a kind of destruction of childhood.
That's very interesting. And of course, some of the old players, the top old players, I mean, people like Bobby Charlton, you know, who, yeah, maybe not around anymore, but they've dropped comments to say things that, well, all these academies are great, aren't they? But if the child hasn't shown an inclination, a love for playing with footballs, you know, even before the age of going to an academy, you can train 10,000 children and miss the point. I think his idea was that
it's a what culture?
It's a street culture. It goes deeper than a thing that can be bought in. It's a street culture thing as well.
Yeah.
You know, their parents have to be into it. Friends have to be into it. There has to be a love for it within the local community, not something that one can impose top down. In that context, the Chinese sort of mass introduction of training academies may not produce the results that they want. And in that light, then, football could seem to be a cultural phenomenon, I'm questioning, rather than just a sport. And that cultural phenomenon is quite difficult to replicate, I should imagine.
Well, it is, but I think Charlton is probably romancing somewhat, which is understandable. I mean, he's 80-odd now. He came into the England team in the late 1950s. And Bobby Charlton, I think, was the tail end of a generation which did, in all probability, learn to play football, kicking a ball of rags around a Cobble Street, somewhere in the north of England. And in his case, he comes from Ashington in Northumberland, which is a noted football town. But I think all that stuff has gone now. You know, the sort of world we're talking about is very organized, very institutionalized, very streamlined. It's industrialized, is the word I want. And children who are spotted playing on the local park at the age of four really haven't had a chance to make choices in life or to inhabit a street culture. They're not old enough. And I think Charlton would admit that his club, Manchester United, are as guilty as anybody else of that. I mean, they're a top football brand. They have a global following. You know, the days of Matt Busby are long gone. And they participate in a kind of assembly line football process, the same as everybody else in the elite game. It's not specific to China.
Right. Now, if we go back to the World Cup that's just finished in Moscow, which has been quite an amazing success, I think, for at least for Russia. And suddenly, I think the world is looking at Moscow, perhaps only temporarily, in a slightly different way because of this amazing event that's taken place. But there weren't any teams from Asia there, really, were there? Apart from Japan, South Korea and Saudi Arabia, which you could question is in Asia at all. Is this the new norm? Is this the way it's always going to be? Well, we've said that China may be coming up, but it's going to be coming up in 10 or 20 years' time, isn't it? It's not going to happen tomorrow. Australasia doesn't seem to be bothered too much. You know, it's sunny down there all the time. You know, Vietnam, Cambodia, those countries, Myanmar, doesn't look as though they're really going to get into this any time soon, to that level of professionalism at least. Can we then presume that the World Cup for the foreseeable future is not really going to be a World Cup at all? It's going to be the Western World's Cup?
It's a good question. It's also a kind of rephrasing of the question that we've been discussing. I think the answer, first of all, is probably yes. We're looking at a continuation of a kind of Western-centric pattern to World Cup victories, which is simply a reflection, I think, of the distribution of football wealth. I mean, as I've said already, the richest and most powerful and influential leagues are in Europe and have been since the First World War. But it's also a question of what these countries want. As I said, if you ask the people of Myanmar, for example, who've been living under a brutal military dictatorship for some time and are also ravaged by massive intercommunal strife, if you ask them, what do you want, peace and prosperity or a successful football team, I think they'd probably go for peace and prosperity. And, you know, this is not a trivial question. As I say, I think it will grow rather than diminish in importance. I've no doubt also that there are already arguments in Mexico. If you look at the contradictions there, you have in Mexico a country which is greatly impoverished, largely because of conditions imposed upon them by the United States government and international financial institutions, to the point where there's great poverty in Mexico and consequent migration to the United States, where, as we've all seen, parents and children are separated and children are put in cages. Extraordinary paradox of the United States and Mexico sharing the World Cup after next. And again, if you ask most people in Mexico, which do you want? Do you want harmonious relationship with the United States plus peace and prosperity, or do you want the World Cup? I'm sure that they go for the former. I know I would.
Yeah. Okay, let's carry on this very interesting conversation after a short break. Welcome back to Pivot to Asia programme. My name's John Harrison. I'm talking to Professor Stephen Wagg from the Leeds Beckett University in the UK about the lack of teams from Asia in the World Cup. In the first part of the programme, we discuss the real reasons why many countries do not make it through to the final stages of the Cup. And we realise that it concerns many developing countries worldwide, not only those in Asia. We also talked about how international football is to a certain extent a reflection of the continuing effects of colonialism. Could we say then, Dr. Wagg, that the international nature of football is really a manifestation of post-colonialism? Or would that be taking it too far?
Well, post-colonialism, I think, is inescapable, because even though the former colonial territories long ago achieved their independence, many of them are struggling economically. And they're struggling economically for reasons that are quite well known. And there is a crisis in these countries of public spending. They've been obliged to privatize a lot of their public assets. And this is a global pattern now. And one of the consequences in the world of sport has been increased opposition, as I've said earlier, to these international tournaments. The best example, I think, is the Olympics, it's becoming more and more difficult for the International Olympic Committee to find cities who will bid to stage these games because they are so expensive. And I think in time, you know, the FIFA may find similar problems. Certainly the World Cup doesn't seem to be spread around that much. I mean, Mexico are getting it for the second time. The States are getting it for the second time. Admittedly, Qatar and Russia were new, but a small number of countries will be able to stage this kind of event. And those countries, many of their citizens will feel that there are other priorities.
Yeah. So if this institution, this championship, is to become a truly global phenomenon, then it would demand then two things. It would demand, firstly, that those so-called developing countries then want to take part. And for them to want to take part, it means that the structure of the organization of the World Cup has got to change. It has to be something that perhaps is not so resource dependent. Something that doesn't demand huge amounts of capital investment and so on and so on. It has to become more flexible.
I think a lot of people would welcome that. I know there is a lobby growing around the world among political commentators, activists, academics, pleading for the Olympics, for example, to be scaled down to something like it once was. To my mind, the Olympics of 1948 are the Olympics which nearest approach the professed Olympic ideal of the amateur spirit and so on. The World Cup, I just don't know. Football at the elite level is so in the grip of the financial elites that it's difficult to see them loosening their hold in the foreseeable future. But I think, you know, to summarize the sort of discussion we've had, the prospects of the smaller, more peripheral nations that you've mentioned, you know, Myanmar, Vietnam, and so on, the prospects of them breaching this elite are slim. And I think, secondly, the chances that many of their citizens would actually want to, in preference to other social and political objectives, are also questionable. You know, that's the way I see it.
Yeah, well, that's actually quite depressing. Thank you, because it's very, very realistic and actually very pragmatic. That's probably exactly what's going on. Well, I mean, I think that we need to end this program perhaps in a slightly positive light. But I mean, what I find so interesting is that each country has its own sport, its own national sport, or the sport that it's adopted and has become almost national. I'm thinking of cricket in India, you know, which is obviously not an Indian natural sport. It was introduced by a British colonialist, but nevertheless, it's become a national, truly national phenomenon. And one really wonders whether the Indians actually have to be expert footballers, you know, to be Indian. They don't, do they?
I think probably opinion is divided in India. I mean, there is a lobby that says they should take the same route that Russia, China, and other countries have taken. They should try and stage international tournaments. They had the Commonwealth Games, and they made a bit of a mess of it. Other countries are coming up on the rails. Qatar, for example, has applied for every tournament that it was eligible to stage and has the next football World Cup. But to get to the remark you made, John, I mean, it really does depend what you call positive, like I've said. I mean, I love football. I've loved it all my life and will go on loving it. I love playing it. I love watching it. And I love arguing about it. But to me, it's still positive that people in countries around the world think that there are more important things than football. And I think it's a positive note that maybe people would rather that there were other social priorities than an elite football team that has a chance of winning the World Cup. The elite in India, I think, has settled for dominating world cricket, which is what they do. They dominate world cricket bureaucratically and in terms of governance, as well as having the best team. In the case of football, realistically, it's quite difficult to separate countries except at the World Cup. Because if you look at the top brands, for example, the Premiership clubs, the top French club, Paris Saint-Germain, top English club, Manchester City, they're floated on top of an ocean of Middle Eastern petrodollars. Mm. You know, they're not uniquely or exclusively English, far from it. And likewise, they draw in their football talent, as we've been saying, from far and wide. Arsenal, for example, have scarcely had an English player in recent times. So there is that, you know.
Right. So it is actually a globalized phenomenon then. It's a kind of globalized local football teams.
Well, I mean, if you had a bunch of students and you wanted to illustrate the concept of globalization, then you couldn't do much better than looking at elite football.
To survive further the World Cup, the financial elite, as you call them, who basically pull the strings, organising these events, planning these events, will they then have to adapt because they may not survive? They may not be able to hold World Cups in the way that they have been so far unless they change? Or do you see them developing in perpetuity, just carrying on doing what they like, regardless of what, you know?
Well, to be honest, John, and I can recommend my colleagues John Sugden and Alan Tomlinson at Brighton University for this. Their work is a revelation on FIFA. Mm-hmm. FIFA are not known for their progressive ideas, and I think, you know, social change will have to boot them up the backside before they make any reforms. They're notoriously corrupt, and they've been pretty much corporatized since the 1970s. You know, the big corporations have been putting a lot of money into FIFA. FIFA, of course, is a kind of registered charity. It runs an enormously lucrative operation, and while it does so, I can't think that it sees the need to change. So I don't think it will change until it has to, and that really doesn't bode well for these smaller nations that you're talking about. I mean, they participate. But I think it's plain to see that they're still only really making up the numbers. They get eliminated in the early rounds. And to my mind, as I've said a couple of times already, that's not necessarily a bad thing, given the other social and political priorities that prevail in those countries.
Right. Well, thank you very much indeed for shedding some light on this matter and giving us perhaps a slightly alternative view of what's just been happening and what's been going to happen in the next international tournament. You used the word international by mistake, probably, but perhaps it should be called an international tournament and not a world tournament. It's less presumptuous, perhaps.
Well, sure, there are nations, but there is also the transnational. You know, I mean, there is America, for example, and there is China, but Walmart works in both countries.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Good point, yeah. Well, thank you very much indeed for your time, Professor Stephen Wagg from the Leeds Beckett University.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
And thank you very much, listeners, for being with us today.
Bye then.
Before we close the programme, may I remind listeners that all of our programmes can be accessed at any time on the site sputniknews.com/radio. Now, if you want to listen to only Pivot to Asia programmes or programmes of any other show, you can find all the editions of that particular show by hitting the radio button and then the show that you want. I'd also like to mention that us hosts are very happy to hear from listeners who'd like to send us any comments, suggestions or questions. You'll find a comments box at the bottom of the text describing each show on the site. Happy listening and tune in again to next week's Pivot to Asia programme. Goodbye.